time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and guests.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing in the news, behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, this is going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station we're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, and this evening our guest is Cal Grunwald, who sells gold and silver, and he supports Radio Liberty, and we support him. We think he's done a good job for a lot of the listeners who called him and talked to him. And we're going to be talking this evening about what's going on. Now, for those of you who heard the President's speech this evening, the State of the Union message, the President said that the economy is strong. He said that the unemployment is down, that inflation is down. Things are really looking pretty good. We're expanding. We've got 7 million new jobs that have been created. And, well, then, of course, the senator from Virginia came on, freshman senator, who really pointed out that the problem is, although they keep telling us how good things are, why, many of our factories are just picking up and moving to other countries. Many of our jobs are being offshored. There's a tremendous disparity between the wages of the CEOs, certainly the people who are running the companies, and the wages of the average worker, and the wages of the average worker are not rising at all. Certainly, President Bush talked about the problems with Social Security, and I think everybody realizes we have problems with Social Security, but he didn't mention the fact that recently Dr. Kiplikoff, who's an economist, wrote an article for the St. Louis Federal Reserve Board, and you can get this off the internet. Kiplikoff, K-I-T-L-I-K-O-F-F, you can Google that in, and St. Louis Federal Reserve. And he says we're frankly bankrupt. There's no way we can pay off all the obligations. President Bush said we were going to have the budget balanced by the year 2009, or we were going to get the expenditures down anyway, moving towards a balanced budget, and yet he's talking about cutting taxes and increasing spending, and there's just no possible way you can do that. And besides that, when they calculate the budget, well, they always leave off the cost of the war, the cost of the earmarks, the cost of so many things, and the fact that they're stealing all the money from Social Security and Medicare that should be going into a fund, so we would have an actuarially sound Social Security system. And there is no lockbox, and there is no money. It is simply a massive debt, which there is no possible way to ever pay back. So, I mean, the question is, are the Democrats correct? Are the Republicans correct? And certainly all the problems we have as far as the Social Security didn't start with the Republicans. It came from the Democrats. It's sort of a bipartisan failure to address the problem. In other words, both political parties are moving to destroy the value of our currency and ultimately bankrupt America. Well, that is the background, Cal Grunwald. How are you doing tonight?
Well, just fine. How are you, Dr. Steve?
I'm fine. Did you hear the President's speech?
No, I didn't. I was on the road, so I'm glad for your little recap there.
Well, I think the most significant thing that the senator from Virginia said was that the attack on Iraq had nothing to do with the war on terror. We should have finished the war on terror and captured Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, but the war and the attack on Iraq had nothing to do with the war on terror. The terrorists weren't coming from Iraq. They were al-Qaeda, and they were in Afghanistan. and when our troops were in a position to capture the Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, why the Bush administration would not allow them to. And then, of course, we moved down into Iraq, and we're in a terrible situation there. Now, we're going to be back here in just a few minutes to start talking about the economy, what's really happening to gold and silver, which we see moving fairly well, and what the future really holds for the economy, and how people in our society can begin making preparations to protect themselves from the very real problems I see coming down the line. Well, Cal, you go ahead and speak up there.
Well, again, I'm on the phone a lot with people around the country, and I get a very, very accurate picture of how things really are with the economy. And, of course, as you went through the itinerary there and did Bush's speech, everything he said was, of course, propaganda and a lie. And, you know, I'm talking to people all over the country, and they're telling me that, if, you know, I talked to a man in Michigan this week, and, you know, there were three factories in, within a 20-mile radius that closed down. People are trying to sell their houses. There's the sale signs all over the place. No, the housing market is totally at a standstill. Nobody's buying, nobody's selling, you know, no jobs. I mean, this is what's going on all over the country. But, you know, our economy is strong. You have to realize that.
Well, I think that the thing is that the market is really up. It's sort of it's really over 1250. The problem is the market is manipulated. It's manipulated by the Treasury and by the Federal Reserve Board, and working in concert with some of the large stock companies by something called the Plunge Protection Team, which was authorized under the Reagan administration to keep and prevent a precipitous drop, you know, in the stock market, which would panic people. But instead of using it for that purpose, the Plunge Protection Team is used on a regular basis now. So at least the Dow Jones industrials will be up, and everybody will feel happy because they see those figures. But the truth of the matter is that our economy is not doing well. Certainly, the corporate profits are really doing fairly well, but most of those corporations are producing their goods overseas. The two major industries in the United States, one is the automotive industry, the second one is the housing industry, and both of these are in real trouble. Certainly, General Motors is moving its operations to China. Ford is moving its operations to China. Chrysler is going to begin actually selling a Chinese-made automobile under a Chrysler name here in the United States. It's called the Chery, I think is the name of the Chinese car, and they'll be able to produce these and get them over here. $8,000 to $10,000 for a car. It's probably not a luxury car, but certainly a serviceable car. And so, basically, America's economy is not good, and the factories are continuing to leave our country. Our better jobs are continuing to leave our country. Much in the way of engineering and architecture and even the reading of x-rays and reading of CT scans and MRIs is being done in India and other countries, and more people, Americans, are finding themselves without work. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Cal was just saying he's talking to people all across the country every day on the telephone, and certainly in the Michigan area. Why, there have been one gentleman he talked to, three factories have shut down in the proximity there. Of course, houses, at least in the Michigan area, are not selling. And we know, of course, the bottom has dropped out of the housing market in many parts of the country. Some places, housing prices have fallen dramatically. Others, they've simply leveled out. A few places, they're still going up. But certainly the housing market doesn't look very good, does it, Cal?
No, and as I may have mentioned the last show, but maybe I didn't, but the housing market in Minneapolis is falling out, you know, the bottom's falling out of that too. And I know a contractor up there, and he says just nothing is, like he had to file bankruptcy, you know, because nothing was moving. He had 20 spec homes. There's a huge developer about 30 miles south of Minneapolis that had 25 to 30 houses that were $300,000 to $500,000. Not one of them selling. The land used to sell $4,000 to $5,000 an acre. There was kind of people moving out of Minneapolis into the country. They're not selling any land anymore either. It's just absolutely stone dead.
Well, I think that, of course, what's happened is so many of the developers really don't understand the economic cycles. And as long as money is readily available, people are going to buy expensive homes. But when money begins to dry up, or at least begins to cut back, and of course for a while they raised the interest rates on loans for houses, they've actually dropped that to try to keep this whole thing from collapsing, but at least in lots of parts of the country, people are beginning to become reluctant to go deeply in debt because they don't know whether they're going to be able to make enough money to be able to actually make the monthly payments. Would that be a fair assessment, Cal?
Well, yes, and I'm glad you brought that up because I'm not saying that this is a movement or a trend, but I'm talking to a lot of people, and it's kind of amazing how, you know, thoughts kind of run across the country among people that are tuned into truth, and people are getting really skittish now just about that very thing, going into debt. In fact, it's a lot of people who have owned their homes are considering selling, you know, taking their equity out and then renting. Of course, this is what I did in 1998. Sold my house, moved to Minneapolis, and I've been renting it. I rented then, and I'm renting now, and I'll never own another house because I'm cutting down my exposure to the system and my exposure to risk. So if you have a house, you know, the mortgage payment, what happens if you lose your job? Well, if you're renting, what happens if you lose your job? You know, you can, you know, kind of make ends meet here and there, and you don't have that great big albatross over your head. You know, the mortgage payment and the taxes and everything else. So it's people are beginning to pare down now and you know, get kind of more of a realistic down to earth. Well, we see what's happening. We can tell this thing is upon us. They see the falling dollar. As you've been saying, all these jobs are going. They see the economy is really, really bad. It's in a critical state. And so the people who are pulling back and paring down and, renting, you know, cutting down their expenses, tightening the belt. I'm talking to a couple in Pennsylvania that, he's got a basement waterproofing business, and he was considering buying another building. But his business is doing fairly well. But then he said, well, considering what's in front of us, I think I'm just going to wait. I'm going to wait 6 months or a year and see what happens because he knows that things are coming down. So people who are tuned in and they know the truth, they see what's coming and it's not pretty, and they're adjusting their lifestyles. They're getting prepared for the worst. And that this isn't about doom and gloom. It's just about realism. You know, what is happening? And, you know, people that are tuned into shows like yours and other alternative radio stations are seeing what's happening, and they're getting kind of concerned and afraid, and they are very, very cautious. They're just sitting on the sidelines and saying, what do I do next? I can't really make any big moves to stick my neck out or get out on a limb because it might get cut off.
Well, I think it's so interesting to see what's happened in other countries, to see what happened in Japan. You know, Japan had one of the most vibrant economies in the entire world. And probably 20 years ago, I think 8 of the world's largest banks were in Japan, and the property values of Tokyo were equivalent to the property values of the entire United States. I mean, property was selling at phenomenal rates in Tokyo, had no relationship to anything, they were simply bidding the prices up. And of course, the Japanese were coming over, and they bought the Empire State Building and Rockefeller Center, and they bought the big golf course over there, the Del Monte Golf Course over in Monterey, and Japanese were buying up things all across the world. And then their economy turned down, and property values fell 90% in many places. The people who had invested in the stock market over there lost everything that they thought they had, all this wealth, and of course it created a terrible psychological problem for the Japanese. So they began lowering the interest rates, and they lowered the interest rates, and they finally got them down to 1% and then to 0%. I mean, you could borrow money. Didn't cost you anything to try to get the economy going again. And, of course, those largest banks in the world, the 8 of the 10 largest banks in the world, many of their stocks would have been selling for, I don't know, $25, $50 a share, were now penny stocks. And Japan, to this very date, has not really been able to get their economy going. Oh, it's recovered a little bit, but they still have to keep their interest rates down to 1-1.5% to try to get people to borrow money to try to stimulate the economy. And if you know what happens in countries when they go through the economic cycle, why, of course, you could see what could very well happen here. The problem is that right now Japan is creating all sorts of money out of nothing and circulating throughout the world, and the world is awash with money. There's all this money out there, but there's nothing behind it. And a lot of that money is going into the hedge funds, and certainly part of that's going into the stock market and keeping the stock market up, and I think it's being manipulated as well. But it's not a healthy situation, because even though the president says we have very low inflation, if you look at the M3 figures, which government steadfastly refuses to print because they say it's so complicated, it's so expensive to come up with the M3 figures, which is the monetary increment of the total amount of money that is out there in that the United States has created, and it's really more than currency in circulation. It is actually all the credit they've created as well, but certainly the people who are looking at it say we're increasing it at about the rate of 12-14% of a year, which is the real rate of inflation. Now, of course, inflation's down somewhat since the price of gasoline has dropped here, but that'll give people more money to spend when they're not having to put it out on. But how long the price of oil and gasoline will be down, we just don't know. That depends really whether or not we go to war with Iran here in a few months from now. Because if we do, I fear that the price of oil will go up again. What are you hearing as far as the possibility of a conflict in the Middle East, Cal?
Well, that's really brewing, and it's getting worse and worse. And, you know, Russia just got done shipping all their M1TR missiles, you know,
They're anti-aircraft missiles to Iran.
Yeah, they're anti-aircraft, you know, and they're supposed to be the most sophisticated in the world, but there's no defense against them. And of course, it was propaganda. I don't know. We don't know, but we know that Russia is very advanced in weaponry. So, you know, all the other side is getting armed, and you know, Israel's pretty much sitting there, and they're lobbing missiles and rockets into Israel almost every day. Israel's just sitting there and taking it. So people are pretty upset with the prime minister over there for not taking some action, and sooner or later it's going to happen. It's going to erupt, and then the whole world's going to be drawn into the conflict. And then anything can happen after that. You know, another aircraft carrier, as you probably heard, is on the way, you know, to the Persian Gulf, and you know, all those moves and all those things are for naught. There's something going to happen, and it's going to be very soon, I think.
Well, if the Russians apparently have sold the Iranians some very sophisticated missiles that they can put on their submarines. Now, Iran doesn't have any nuclear submarines like we do. Theirs are old diesel submarines, but armed with sophisticated weapons that can take out a carrier, why, they can certainly be very, very dangerous to this massive naval force that we're building up in the Persian Gulf. We have the Eisenhower Group, the John Stennis Group, we have the Boxer Strike Force, which is really very interesting. The Boxer itself looks like an aircraft carrier. It's not as big as an aircraft carrier. Big flat deck for small planes and, of course, for helicopters, so they can ferry massive numbers of probably Marines or certainly very well-trained forces, American military forces. But where are we going to send them? I mean, are we going to put them in Baghdad? No. I mean, the only logical place would be to put them ashore in Iran or adjacent to Iran in case there is a military confrontation there. And this is the thing that really disturbs me. And this is why I think that we should get out from that area as soon as we can before something happens. Maybe an incident, maybe accidental, maybe planned, and maybe staged, like the Gulf of Tonkin incident, to expand the war in the Middle East. And if that should happen, of course, the effect on our economy could really be devastating. Well, yeah. Cal, what are the people you're talking to doing? Are they investing in gold or silver? Are they investing in stocks? Are they investing in gold and silver stocks? What are the people you're talking to doing to protect themselves for the difficult times that lie ahead? Because I'm sure the people you're talking to are fairly well informed.
Oh, they are. And I've noticed rather dramatic increase in purchasing or buying in the last couple, 3 weeks. As gold is climbing up, and it's all psychology, but people are buying, and they're getting very concerned about what they see, what they hear, what they know is happening around them.
Isn't it interesting? When the price is down, nobody wants to buy. When the price starts to rise, everybody wants to get on before it goes any higher. And where did it close today? It looked like it was getting up towards 640, wasn't it?
640, 690.
Really? It really took a strong out?
It was up $11, $12 today. So.
What about silver? How did
silver is 1325 it finished.
That was a dramatic increase. So, obviously, something's going on. We'll be right back here with Cal Grunwald. Well, Cal, that was really a dramatic increase in the price of gold and silver today. What do you attribute that to? Do you have any idea? One of those things that we may not know for a few weeks. Is it the old canary in the mine shaft phenomenon? It's pointing to the fact that there's something dangerous there, but we don't know what killed the canary, and we don't know why these things are going up, but somebody does?
Well, yes, and it's not me. Not me. Again, it's just... it's all a manipulation, and, you know, they just probably take their hands off for a couple of days, and then it goes up. But then they get back in there, and they decide to beat it down, so it is. And everybody gets discouraged. Oh, gold went down. I lost money. Why do I want to get into that? It's all a big mind game that they play with the public. And unless you know their tactics and their modus operandi, you're going to get mesmerized and fooled by it. You're going to sit on the sidelines and do absolutely nothing. And that's where most people are right now, on the sidelines. But again, a few people who know, they are buying because they're concerned. These things have happened to them. Maybe they've lost a job, or maybe they have friends that have, and they understand, you know, like the things that you talk about on your show. These are the people who buy because they know it's not, you know, the dollar doesn't have long for this world, and you know, all the conflict in the world, the world economy is horrible. You know, the world is basically switched over to the euro now out of the dollar. You know, China is going to be selling off or dumping a trillion of their dollars. And it's, you know, all the reasons are right there. If just everybody puts them together and, you know, sees the big picture, then they do something about their wealth.
Well, you know, I think it's really very interesting that recently it's been announced that there are actually far more euros in circulation than there are dollars in circulation. And, of course, it's been said for some time, well, you know, the euro could not replace the dollar as the reserve currency of the world because there aren't enough euros out there. And then suddenly, just within the last few weeks, we've heard them saying, well, actually, there's more euro dollars out there than there are American dollars. Have you heard that?
No, that's interesting. Very interesting. I haven't heard that.
And whether that's true or not, of course, you hear a lot of things, but certainly they seem to be expanding the number of euros, but that's highly, highly inflationary. And, of course, people have to understand that there are certain things, like there's money in circulation. We have about 700 and, oh, maybe $20 billion. That's actual money. That's coins and bills. But then built upon that is about, well, let's see, probably 10 times that amount. Probably even more than that, about 10 times that amount of credit that's out there created by the fractional reserve system. So they can create money out of nothing, and it's all bank entries, but it can be bought and sell, and you could buy a house or a factory or something with that. And so we're massively increasing this credit that's out there, these monetary increments. And my fear is they're going to have a profound impact on the world economy, especially as we hear China talking about moving out of the dollar. Now, China really has a very close relationship with Iran, and certainly if we start threatening Iran, why, the Chinese, and cutting off, you know, the Chinese ability to access Iranian oil, the Chinese could take devastating effect attack on us simply by beginning to dump our dollars on the world market. Do you think they might do that?
Well, yes. There's going to be a certain point at which China will.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Cal Grunwald. If you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, our telephone number is 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And something I was pointing out during the break there, that China has very close relationships with Iran. China needs Iranian oil. We want the Iranian oil, too. And so, you know, if America moves against Iran, why, we will control their oil. And the Chinese might not especially appreciate that. And, of course, if we threaten Iran or should create an incident to justify an attack on Iran, is it possible that China would retaliate by beginning to dump American reserves? Now, China has the largest reserves of any nation throughout all history, about $1 trillion, of which about 70 billion of that, 700 billion of that is American dollars. And they could do a tremendous harm to the American economy by getting to sell those dollars on the market or simply bringing them here and starting to buy up all sorts of factories and roadways and certainly businesses here in the United States, comparable to what Japan had done here 15 years ago. And so, I mean, I think we have to really, and of course those dollars then would be in circulation here in America, that would be highly inflationary. So, you know, certainly we are so susceptible to what China does. And suddenly, China has become a major factor as far as America is concerned. And I don't believe there's any love lost between the Chinese and America. China is working to surround America, buying bases and setting up bases all around this country. And, of course, they look upon us as the major threat to their continued dominance of Asia, hegemony over there, and I think that they would like to do harm to us, and they have the ability, not militarily, but financially, and sometimes a financial crisis can be far more devastating even than a military attack. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, at telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Like to know what's happening in your area to the economy. Are things looking pretty good? Are the factories, new factories opening up, or are they closing down? And what about these jobs coming in from other countries, or the ability to send engineering jobs into India to get them done rather than having them done here, or architectural jobs, or so many other jobs are being outsourced throughout the world as America's wealth and technology and jobs are being transferred to other countries? But you go ahead, Cal.
I was just saying that, China is really kind of in the driver's seat. They've got us over the proverbial barrel in the sense that they have those, $1 trillion of our gold reserves. And if they wanted to, deal a death blow without firing a shot, all they have to do is, dump all the dollars and we're all done. And of course, they, now a huge percentage of all the factories in the world are over in China, not only ours, but other countries, and so all they have to do is say Yankee go home and everybody else and nationalize all the factories, and they've got it.
And, of course, the interesting thing is that the government here guaranteed all those American companies and corporations that moved their factories to China that if they were ever expropriated by the Chinese government, that you out there in the listening audience would pay for them. In other words, the people who are moving over to China, their factories have nothing to lose from the fact that they might be nationalized. The American taxpayer will pay for them. They've been guaranteed. In fact, I had a congressman on my program about 2 years ago. They got rid of him. They wanted to get him out of office. He was an honest man. He was from Utah. But he told me that if you invested in China and you opened a big factory over there, and that factory was nationalized or expropriated, you'd not only get back everything you'd invested, you'd get back 2 or 3 times the amount that you invested. So you would actually have a benefit from it being nationalized, and it would all be financed by the American taxpayers. The American taxpayers don't understand that, but the question is, where would the money come from? Our government doesn't have any money. The most carefully kept secret is government doesn't have any money. And then what it takes from the public by taxes, but if it were to take massive amounts of our money by taxes, the economy would collapse. What it can actually create by simply printing money, but that's inflationary. And then what it can borrow from future generations, which is how we're financing the war in Iraq and Afghanistan today. We're doing it all on borrowed money, doing it on the cheap. Isn't hurting us much at all. It's only if one somebody we know and love is over there and been injured or killed. But the average individual really isn't affected by the war that's going on over in Iraq, and that, I think, is a terrible tragedy. Maybe if we were having to pay for it, maybe we'd be much more concerned about asking, why did we go into Iraq? This had nothing to do with the war on terrorism, despite the fact everything that is being said. The war, terrorists were not coming from Iraq. They were coming from Afghanistan, and we let them escape to Pakistan. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and if you're out there across America and like to give us a call, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we've got David calling from Coeur d'Alene. David, did you have a question or comment for our guest?
Well, I just wanted to thank you both and all the patriots out there that are listening in for their individual efforts each day to get the word out. Very evident that the Republic is under attack.
Right.
I just wanted to mention that considering the economy and the history of these criminals that have run this corporatocracy for how many generations now, Cal, if he could go over the constitutional and lawful nature of the product that he is trying to draw the public's attention to and why they need it as an insurance policy against despotism.
Now, of course, you're talking about gold?
Gold and silver.
Gold and silver. Okay, Cal, that's a good question. Would you like to talk about why gold and silver are important as far as protection against despotism? And why is it that those people who would be despots keep telling us gold has absolutely no value? It's an archaic relic of the past.
Well, again, gold and silver are the only real money in the world. Of course, gold is the only monetary metal now, and silver will be once things collapse, once the dollar comes down. But again, it all goes back to Scripture when the Lord said, all the gold and silver are mine. And so the Lord put a value on the two metals. That's why they still have it, and they always will. So when you have gold and silver in your possession, you are independent of the system, so to speak, you know, whatever amount you have. And the more you have in the institutions, whether it's electronic or paper money, it's just it's a mirage or an illusion that you own something or that you have some wealth. So you have to separate yourself or divorce yourself from their system and their institutions, get out of their institutions and get into real money, which is gold and silver. And that way you are pretty much out of their control. Of course, we live in this country and, you know, we're going to be affected by things that they do. But, you know, when martial law comes or, you know, bad times or a terrible depression or recession and the dollar collapses, if you have gold and silver, you have tremendous value in your hand. It's good anywhere in the world. So basically, you're out from under their thumb, and at least you have a chance to survive.
Well, I think it was Daniel Webster, and you've heard the quotation before, but I think it's so apropos in response to David's question. And that is, of all the contrivances for cheating the laboring classes of mankind, none has been more effective than that which deludes them with paper money.
Dr. Stan.
Yes, go ahead. And we have David calling from Coeur d'Alene. Go ahead, David.
Yes, Dr. Stan, I was wondering, were you? I had to send it by ground. I don't have electronic yet, I'm hoping. But were you able to copy that Coeur d'Alene Press article, December 28, 2006, that I sent to you? Will the Amero replace the dollar?
Yes, I saw that, and I thought it was really very, very interesting. And there are many people within the intellectual elite who would like to do away with the dollar as a medium of exchange and merge the financial increments of Mexico, the United States, and Canada. And Mr. Robert Pastor, who is sort of the architect of this whole idea of the North American Union. Of course, he's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's fronting for the Rockefeller interests, those people who would betray certainly our heritage and sacrifice the future of our children and our unborn generations. Mr. Robert Pastor has been talking about creating the Amero. This would be comparable to the Euro which, of course, is the common currency of Europe. Now it would be the Amero, and we could probably cash in, well, maybe $100 for one Amero, something like that. We don't know what it's going to be, but, yes, I really am very, very concerned that they're planning on a new currency, and when you have something like that happens, you never know what the exchange rate will be.
Well, I think it's very telling, and I hope you get a copy over to Mr. Gunwall for his review and be able to put it in people's faces that can't see or hear too well as of yet, only by virtue of the fact that this lady, a matter of record, lied to everybody that read that public press. But what is even more interesting, if you can circle it for Mr. G, that Shiloh Patrick is an alien unregistered foreign agent.
Who is that?
Shiloh Patrick is the lady that wrote this business note in regard to the SPP.gov. She's an attorney of counsel to Palmer George, law firm and former editor of an international trade law journal.
All right, fine. Well, of course, you're talking about this SPP, Security and Prosperity Partnership. That is the master plan to unite the governments and the economies of Mexico, the United States, and Canada, and raise the living standards of the average American to that of the Mexican peasant. Hey, thanks so much for calling, David.
God bless you.
God bless you, right? And again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And I was simply quoting from Daniel Webster. And, of course, this was probably in the early 1800s when Daniel Webster, knowing the history of what had happened in ancient times, and certainly what had happened in the United States, with the First Bank of the United States. Remember, the First Bank of the United States was chartered in 1791, and of course the Congress refused to renew the charter in 1811 because the bank was controlled, at least a third of the stock was controlled by European bankers who were dictating American economic policy, and so Congress refused to renew the charter of the First Bank of the United States. And you know what happened? We had the War of 1812. Why did we have the War of 1812? Oh, shucks, nobody knows why. We just went to war in 1812, supposedly because the British were forcing American sailors on the high seas to join the, forcing them into bondage in British ships. But that's been going on for a long time. So why did we go to war in 1812? Well, of course, it produced terrible suffering, and as a result, and the economic collapse that occurred after the British invasion of America and burning of the White House, then, of course, we ended up with the Second Bank of the United States in 1816. So Daniel Webster, understanding the history of paper money, the continental currency that we used during the Revolutionary War, and, of course, what had happened in France when they tried to have a fiat money system, and, of course, going back to Florence and Venice and all of these countries. This has been tried many times down through the centuries. Daniel Webster wrote this: of all the contrivances for cheating the laboring classes of mankind, none has been more effective than that which deludes them with paper money. Of all the contrivances for cheating the laboring classes of mankind, none has been more effective than that which deludes them with paper money. And right now, I think most people are deluded with this image of paper money. We've got all that money in the bank. We've got those CDs, we've got the annuities, we've got the pensions. We've got so much money, we're so wealthy, our house is worth so much, our stocks are worth so much, all denominated in paper money. Well, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Tell the people you're dealing with out there across America. Are most of them well aware of the fraud of a fiat money system and how fiat money systems down throughout history have always collapsed?
Actually, that's a fact that's hidden from just about 99% of the people. Only the people who listen to, you know, alternative radio, you know, have a clue. It's amazing. It's amazing to me talking to these people that they trust paper. You know, it's not real. It's just ink on a piece of paper, or it's an illusion on a number on a computer chip. But they have the false idea that it's real, and they own it, but it isn't. so trying to convince people that, you know, reality is something else other than what they think is sometimes very difficult.
Well, now, your job at first is to try to get the word out, as is mine. Well, our telephone number, if you're out there across America, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And our guest is Cal Grunvallen. Cal, why don't you get your telephone number out, your website out, and how people get in touch with you?
Okay, well, my telephone number is 414-234-8267. That's 414-234-8267, and I have a website, www.gold, write out the word and, silverexchange.info, goldandsilverexchange.info, and I'm offering a really interesting information package. I've got a 33-page paper now, and it's entitled Gold and How to Avoid the Scams in the Coin Industry, and it's got other documents like an article on the Fort Knox Gold is not there anymore. It's got the emergency banking order, which gives the government the authority of the banks to the authority to close their doors whenever the government says do it. And then there's some very interesting articles out of the 1933 New York Times when Roosevelt confiscated gold, and he instituted 14 new banking regulations. The second one on the list was open safety deposit boxes. So if people don't believe that the banks can take out of your safety deposit box, read that, because they'll do it again. So you can go to my website and then just sign up for my paper, and I can either email it to you or I'll send you a hard copy or both. So go there and kind of check it out. I wanted to comment about the Amaro, too, as long as you were talking about it, because just about everybody asked me about the Amaro, and I've got my own opinion, and I'm not saying I'm right, but just knowing the way the government operates, you know, there's a lot of talk about it, and everything is in place to have it happen at some point. But to me, it's just another psychological game that the government's playing with our minds, and I think what they're planning to do, and of course, you know, once the dollar collapses, we're going to have economic and, you know, physical chaos and riots and, you know, revolts and looting and everything else. That's not too pretty. But somehow they're dangling this false carrot in front of everybody to say, well, don't worry about it, because when our dollar fails, we're going to have the Amaro to take its place. But what I think is happening and it's going to happen, and I could be wrong, but once our dollar collapses, we're going to go right into the mark of the beast, the cashless society, the new world order, martial law, and then the government will say, aha, we fooled you again. We promised you the Amaro, but we got you slavery instead.
Well, I think you certainly could be right. We know that they're doing everything they can to number everybody, and they want an RFID chip on every animal, every farm animal. They want it on every product. They want to be able to track everything in the world. They want us to have certainly an identification card. That'll be our news driver's license, and I'm sure that they really want an RFID chip on that. Certainly the new passports that are being issued today have RFID chips in them. They want to be able to track everybody. And I think it's really so interesting. We've learned in the last couple of weeks that every cell phone for many years has had a microphone switch in it, so that you have your cell phone turned off. You're not talking to into it, but they can listen to your conversation. This came out accidentally during an appeal on a conviction of some mafia people, and they've been listening to their conversations through their cell phones. And of course, the mafia people had been sweeping the rooms for bugs, and they figured they had everything covered, but they didn't understand. Just as many Americans don't understand, that every cell phone for many years has had a little switch there, and whenever they want to listen to what you're saying, why, they can simply flip that switch, and wherever you are, through the miracle of a satellite, electronic communication, they can hear what you're saying. My goodness, I wonder why they built that into all those cell phones. You know, you go down and you buy one cell phone and they give you three free. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, they really like it if you get three free cell phones, but Could it be that they really want to hear our conversations? Could it be there are people who have a different worldview and really want to control everything? Well, let's go to Daniela in Santa Cruz. Hi, Daniela.
Hello, Dr. Stan. I'm here visiting, and I fell upon your program. And
where are you visiting from? From England?
No, from Los Angeles.
Okay, fine. Go ahead.
And you were a while ago, about half an hour ago, you were speaking about the real estate market, and then the concept of paper money.
Right.
I was wondering if we're both retired. We recently retired, my husband and I, and we were advised for the first time in our life to owe a lot on a piece of property, our house.
Why would you want to owe a lot on a piece of property in your house?
Well, just to have a little more cash to spend.
But if you spend that money, you've got to pay it back, and you've got to pay interest on it. Why would you want to, if you're retired, why would you want to be putting large amounts of interest out? I mean, who wants you to do that? Who wants you to go into debt at this time in the economic cycle?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been reading different articles about the fact that this is a good thing to do, and that the concept of not owing any debt is very, you know, passé, it's old, it's...
All right, well, what do you say about Daniela? They're trying to get her to, you know, to borrow on her house and to spend that money and live it up.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to Daniela?
Well, again, considering what's going on in the country, you know, it's time to be very, very careful and not to spend a dollar that you don't have, because when things collapse, you're not going to be able to pay it back, and then the bank can come get your house.
And then where would you live, Daniel, if they took your house?
Yeah.
And right now, if you watch television, they have all these advertisements for the older people, and they have Robert Wagner and a number of very people, well-known actors, and they're all saying, just take out this negative amortization loan. You just go ahead and start borrowing money on your home, and you can just live in your home, and you can live it up and spend all the money. And they... These are scams. They may encourage you to do it, but one day, every month, you're going to owe more money on your house. Mm-hmm. And when you owe enough money on your house, why, maybe you'll owe more money than the house is actually worth, because the price of houses goes down, and then what's going to happen? If I were you, I would get out of debt and really consolidate everything. Don't go into debt at this time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be the worst advice in the world why anybody would tell you to do that, unless they wanted to profit off of your situation.
It was based on the fact that real estate is the best place to put your money, and listening to you tonight, you know, it seems that real estate might not be, but of course you're speaking from the East, and in California the picture is always a little bit different.
Right, as it depends on where you live in California. Yeah, but certainly in places like San Diego, the value of homes has actually gone down there.
Yeah.
And certainly in other areas where I am, I don't think the property's gone down, but it's not selling as well as it did.
Yeah.
But I think we're just on the edge of some very real problems. So if I were you, I would get out of debt. I'd consolidate my position and be very conservative, because an awful lot of people are going to end up without a home.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't want to be in that position, would you?
No.
All right. Thank you so much for calling. Incidentally, go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. And we actually carry a number of books on finances that will explain to you the artificial monetary system we have.
Yes.
And how you're going to be able to protect yourself. And my talk on financial tsunami, even if I do say so, is really pretty good.
Yeah.
God bless. Thanks so very much.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Eric, who's calling from Compton. Hi, Eric. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. How are you?
Doing fine. Did you have a question for Cal?
Yes, Cal. I've recently just come to understand that there's something, when it comes to silver, there's something called junk silver, and if something happens in major in the government in America, it's confiscatable, and the government can only, they're only obligated to pay you $2 an ounce. I'm not really sure what that's about or how that works. Can you explain that to me?
Yes, no,
what
I
junk silver is.
Yeah, junk silver is, those are the coins, the dimes, quarters, half dollars, sometimes silver dollars that were minted in our country up until 1964. They were 90% real silver. And then the government took them all off, and then they replaced them with 40% silver, and then pretty much a copper sandwich after that. So junk silver is, you know, the coins are a lot of them very worn. Sometimes you can't even see the dates, but they're real silver. So they're very, very valuable. And those are the coins that I recommend. I recommend a bag of junk silver per household, because you're going to need silver coins for barter when the currency collapses, you know, to buy a loaf of bread or a dozen eggs or a gallon of milk. So it's very important. Now, silver is classified, junk silver is classified as bullion, and it can be confiscated. But the point is, I don't think the government will ever do that, because there's so little value for all the bulk and the weight. But I really do think they're going to try to confiscate gold again, because that's the ultimate compact store of value, and it's the only monetary metal right now. So I would get some junk silver, and don't worry about the confiscation issue.
All right, anything else, Eric?
So if I'm understanding it properly, the word junk doesn't have anything to do with the necessarily to do with the value?
No. It's junk because of the wear on the silver.
And of course, it's not numismatic silver, but it is silver, and these are 90% silver coins, and silver has intrinsic value. And that's what the bankers hate. They don't want you to have anything with intrinsic value.
Is there any, is silver before 1945 any more valuable than silver from 45 to 64?
No, not really.
I think it was up till about 64 it was 90% silver.
Yeah, 64.
And then they had a time when it was 40% silver. What were the dates on that, Cal?
Well, it was just like 1 or 2 years.
About 75, 76, it was 40% silver, and then they took the silver completely out.
Yeah, and then they made a copper sandwich, and now it's like a zinc chromium metal, which is totally worthless.
And, of course, actually, you know, the penny today and the nickel are worth far more than the penny and the nickel, even though there's, you know, no silver in either one of them. But it costs them more, actually, to make a penny or a nickel today than they're actually... if you were to take the penny right now and melt it down, why, it's worth more than a penny. And the same thing is true with the nickel.
Yeah, the penny's worth about 1¾ cents, and in fact, it's now a felony to melt pennies down.
Yeah, right. So don't you do that, Eric. Anything else you want to ask?
Well, just one more quick question, Dr. Stan. How do you, if you had some gold or silver, where would you take it and to find the value of it, what you do have, or any rare coin?
Well, again, that's my business. If you want to call me and tell say what you have, then I'll be glad to tell you what it's worth.
Okay.
Is that what you're asking, or later on when the dollar collapses?
Probably later on.
Well, this is what I kind of present in my paper in a very, very logical way, how you can determine once the dollar collapses, how you can determine the value of any real true silver coin, like a junk silver coin or a silver dollar or a gold coin. I give kind of a very logical scenario. All you really have to do is multiply the silver content of that particular coin times the value of silver any particular day per ounce. So, for instance, if silver, you know, is $50 an ounce and you have a dime, a dime contains 0.07 of an ounce of silver. So if you multiply 0.07 times $50, you get $3.50. Now, that would be like the purchasing power of that coin on the street. On the day that silver is $50 an ounce, because you are, you know, whatever is the silver content in the coin is constant. So the dime is 0.07, the quarter is 0.18 of an ounce, the half dollar is 0.366, and the silver dollar is 0.77. So once you know the silver content of the coin, all you have to do is multiply it by the value of silver per ounce that day, and then you get the value of the coin. It's pretty simple. Do the same thing for gold.
Hey, we're out of time. Thanks so much, Eric.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and our guest has been Cal Grunwald, why don't you get your telephone number and your website off one more time before we let you go?
Yes, it's 414-234-8267, 414-234-8267, and my website is www.goldandsilverexchange.info, goldandsilverexchange.info.
Well, thank you very much. We'll look forward to talking to you again next month.
And thanks, Dr.
Good night. God bless. Okay, that was Cal Grunwald, and of course, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we really depend on those of you who listen to our programs to, you know, join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, to subscribe to the newsletter, or if you'd like a free copy of the newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We have a unique opportunity. We're on a, I think I counted the other day, about 55 outlets every single week all across America, shortwave, internet, satellite, and on several satellites. And so we have an opportunity to reach people with the information they're not going to get elsewhere. If you really want to understand what's happening, let me suggest my talk on the financial tsunami. And it comes with a syllabus, and you get them together as a special offer. And that's the financial tsunami. And you call us at 1-800-544-8927. Probably the best single book to understand how this all fits together is Ed Griffin's wonderful book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. The Creature from Jekyll Island. We carry a book written by Professors Sutton, Anthony Sutton, called The Federal Reserve Conspiracy. It's just a small book, but it will give you tremendous insight into how this artificial monetary system works. And it's set up this way. They win, we lose. They win, we lose. And then we have put together a little pamphlet based upon a number of articles I've written on monetary system. It's called The History of Money. It's straightforward. And of course, you read it, you'll know more about the monetary system than most professors do. It's 5 newsletters, and that's The History of Money. And then probably one of my favorite books was written well over 125 years ago by Arthur Dickinson White, and of course he was the dean of Cornell University. He was writing about what happened in France in 1789 and 1790 and 1791 when they tried exactly what we're doing today. The book is entitled Fiat Money Inflation in France. It's a classic, and you see the moral breakdown, the loss of integrity. Everybody was going to get rich, and they did get rich. I mean, it was the most phenomenal thing that ever happened to France. Tremendous prosperity for a time. And then, of course, when the whole thing collapsed, why, they ended up with a dictatorship under a man named Napoleon Bonaparte. Well, of course, our telephone number again is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And our website is radioliberty.com, and you can go there. You can listen to our programs on the internet directly 3 hours a day, and then on other networks 2 hours a day. You can listen 4 hours a day to the shortwave, and certainly we're on satellite. Telstar 5, right along with Al Jazeera, but you can listen to us 9 hours a day there, because there's a lot of that is a repeat, and then you can listen to Joyce Riley. And Joyce and I and two of our friends are on this satellite 24 hours a day. We hope that many of you will go to the website and tell other people about our programs on internet, on shortwave, on radio stations, and on satellite. And what our job is to try to get people educated. We are entering a very difficult time financially. I believe time is really running out. Get yourself in the best shape you possibly can. Hope and pray that we do not expand the war in the Middle East and use some guise or another for Gulf of Tonkin incident. Incidentally, the Gulf of Tonkin didn't occur, and 58,000 American boys died. But maybe we'll call it a Persian Gulf incident and get ourselves into a war with Iran. Remember, the attack on Iraq had nothing to do with terrorism. Had nothing to do with terrorism. Good night. God bless you. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Christian civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, but please hold your calls until we ask for them. Our guest this hour is an old friend. I've known Dr. Paul Cameron for 20 years. When 20 years ago, 1986, 1987, why, that's when I got involved on the front lines of the battle to try to stop the AIDS epidemic by using effective and public health measures, the kind we would use with every other disease, to try to stop this entirely new disease, a retroviral disease that was having a devastating effect on the homosexual population of America. And Paul Cameron was out there. He's a psychologist, but he has an institute, the Family Research Institute, and he's been working for a long time to tell people about the homosexual lifestyle and really its devastating effect on not only on society but on the homosexual himself. And really, this is certainly not a healthy lifestyle at all. That is not a happy one. If you care about homosexuals, you're certainly going to let them know that. Well, anyway, this evening, a lot of water's gone under the bridge since we got started back in those days, hasn't it, Paul?
It certainly has. And now we have a situation where AIDS, the disease, instead of leading to the demise of the homosexual movement, has ended up almost completely funding the homosexual or the gay movement. It's one of those strange twists of fate.
Right.
We're the kind of a society that I guess we can be conned pretty easily, and we're kind of soft touches for the idea that if something terrible is happening, we can do something about it, and the only people who really know about such things are people who are actually suffering with a disease or in line to suffer for the disease. And so we've gotten in a strange situation where literally billions of dollars are being spent to quote-unquote educate the homosexual community, and almost all those educators, almost all the writers that write the educational pamphlets and do the cartoons, do the PSA, the public service announcements and so forth, are homosexuals. And so even though there is scant evidence that any of this education has worked, at least with the homosexuals, we still keep paying the bill. And of course, the scientists keep trying to figure a way to slow or hopefully cure this particular disease.
Okay, well, we were going to talk this evening. What about Obama? Was that it?
In part, yes.
Okay, well, you go ahead.
Well, we kind of have a strange situation here, don't we? We're in a society that one of the main wellsprings of why we think what we do and do what we do is in tribute to the notion of equality, that everybody is essentially equal to everybody else. And Obama comes on the scene almost unknown, a pretty obscure fellow who kind of got lucky in being elected to the Senate. If the Republican who was opposing him hadn't self-destructed, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation.
All right, will you hold that? We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Paul Cameron talking about the presidential candidacy of Senator Obama. And the question is, who's really behind him? Go right ahead there, Paul.
Yes. Well, here we have this fairly obscure fellow
about whom we know relatively little. Just yesterday, it was alleged, asserted with great confidence, that he had had some of his education as a Muslim in the sect that is in part responsible for some of the most strict Muslim teachings and, of course, some of the folk that we consider terrorists, who are certainly giving us a run for our money in Iraq and throughout the world.
But, of course, this doesn't make Senator Obama a terrorist at all, because he went to a Muslim school. What was the background of his going to a Muslim school?
Well, it's not completely clear that he actually did.
Well, then, of course, should we even be talking about it until we are actually certain?
Yeah, what's interesting is the allegation is out there that Senator Hillary Clinton, who is ambitious also to become president, the first female president, that her minions spread this information.
All right, so then really we don't we sort of suspect that maybe it may be one of the Hillary's dirty tricks. I'm sure that she will try to destroy anybody who gets in her way.
Well, you'd think. That seems to be the Clinton modus operandi. And in this case, it was carried by none other than the Washington Times, which is certainly among the more right-wing of the nation's publications, and one that you would, I guess, that I read pretty regularly, and I suspect many people on the right do. I don't know whether they've been hoodwinked, whether they sourced this out adequately, but more importantly, even if he was a couple of years at a Muslim school, it would have been when he was pretty young, 6, 7, 8. I don't know what a kid picks up at that age. I doubt much in the way of politics or anything really substantive in terms of his qualifications to be a senator, or in this case, president of the United States. But it's interesting, isn't it, that since that's happened, George Soros, who has more money than you or I, has thrown his lot with Obama and has offered to fund his campaign. So
well,
we have
let me just, when we get back here, somebody just handed me something, and I'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Dr. Cameron is our guest, and he was just commenting that there's a story that's going around that talks about the terrorist ties of Senator Obama. Now, what I have in my hand has no signature on it, has no source of information. It's the sort of thing that you would pass out if you wanted to discredit somebody. Maybe if you were working for Hillary Clinton and you wanted to discredit one of your primary opponents. So let me just read what it says. Barack Hussein is Obama was born in Honolulu, Hawaii, to a black Muslim. Barack Hussein Obama the senior. He actually went to Kenya and then, of course, when Obama was 2 years old, his parents divorced and his father returned to Kenya. His mother married another Muslim, as well, moving to Jakarta with young Obama when he was 6 years old. Within 6 months, he had learned to speak the Indonesian language. Obama spent 2 years in a Muslim school and two more in a Catholic school in Jakarta. Obama takes great care to conceal the fact that he is a Muslim, and mitigating that information by saying that for 2 years he attended a Catholic school. Obama's father, Barack Hussein Obama Sr., was a radical Muslim who migrated from Kenya to Jakarta, Indonesia. He met Obama's mother, Anne Adunham, at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Obama's spin meisters are now attempting to make it appear that Obama's introduction to Islam came from his father, and that influence was only temporary, which is true. Osama Sr. returned to Kenya immediately following the divorce and never again had any direct influence over his son's education, but Lolo Soitoro and Dunham's second husband educated his stepson, Barack Hussein Obama, as a good Muslim by enrolling him in one of Jakarta's Wahhabi schools. Wahhabism is the radical teaching that created the Muslim terrorists who are now waging jihad on the industrialized world. And since it's politically expedient to be a Christian when you're seeking political office in the United States, Obama joined the United Church of Christ to help purge any notion that he's still a Muslim. Pass this around, folks. No notation, no idea where it came from. Obviously, that sounds like the sort of dirty politics you'd expect from somebody who's trying to discredit Obama's candidacy. Would that be a fair statement, Paul?
It sure sounds that way to me. And once again, he has joined a Christian church. It's not a very conservative church. It's, in my opinion, in the realm of barely Christian, certainly not overwhelmingly Orthodox. But he's a member, and I don't know that he's been directly asked what he believes religiously. I'm sure that we'll find out, or at least he'll answer the question. But this is pretty thin gruel to make a story about a fellow.
Well, of course, you know, you can expect a lot of dirty tricks here. We saw what Clinton did. You know, certainly he, he discredited everybody that was ever came up against him. And I know people who were actually physically beaten. I talked to them. I mean, these were people who knew about Bill Clinton's affairs, and they simply sent thugs in to beat them. Some of them, were beaten to the very verge of death and had their arms broken. This was the Clinton. Certainly, this was Bill Clinton. I don't know that we'd think anything different of Hillary.
Well, I have two angles on that. One, I did personally talk to one of the guards, one of his drivers, who worked with him and for him in Arkansas. And he had quite a few tales of, I guess you would say, sexual activities of Mr. Clinton, and I found him a credible fellow, and he didn't seem to be terribly anti-Clinton so much as he was, and, well, kind of embarrassed that a man of such prodigious sexual exploit would be possibly the next president of the United States. Well, he became the next president of the United States.
And, of course, the media covered up for him at every turn.
Yes. And of course, there was that great Super Bowl, in-between Super Bowl interview, where Hillary accepted his quasi-apology and kind of assured the nation that she stood by her man and... If she accepted him and accepted his apology, so should we. I think that was Hillary at her best. A magnificent performance, I thought. And I'm sure you thought. What was your reaction?
Oh, I think that, of course, the whole thing is very carefully staged. Nobody ever was allowed to bring out all the other things. And, of course, really what a nasty, vile, crude individual Hillary was.
Yeah, and here I have another footnote. For a while, I lived in D.C., and across the street from me was a Secret Service agent who actually worked at the White House. And his friend, a good friend, worked literally in with the Clintons for a period of time. And he said that his friend finally decided to quit. He was so turned off by what he called the vilest mouth he'd ever heard from a woman. That woman was Hillary Clinton. And I thought that was very striking. You know, people really, when you get into the Secret Service, you want to serve the president, and it's a special plum to actually serve in the White House and serve the First Family. The tales that I got about her rudeness, the language that she used that would have apparently put even a longshoreman to shame, the kinds of things that she said to the president, the kinds of things she threw at the president. Clearly, this was a woman who, with a temper and with a sense of entitlement, even when she wasn't running for president, it's going to be very interesting to see how she and the Republican, John McCain, handle their respective tempers and the way they approach the world.
Well, I thought it was really very interesting this evening. I don't know, did you see the State of the World address and then the follow-up on that, Paul?
I saw the address. I didn't see the follow-up.
Well, the follow-up, of course, they interviewed senator from, I think it was South Carolina, Republican senator, Lindsey Graham, and then they interviewed Hillary Clinton, Senator Hillary Clinton. Now, why would they pick Hillary Clinton of all the Democratic senators that they could have picked? Why would they pick Hillary? Well, because there are people within the media who are building up her candidacy.
Oh, absolutely.
And, of course, you know, they could have picked Obama. They could have picked lots of people. No, they picked Hillary. In fact, if you watch the State of the Union message this evening, why, of course, several times they zoomed in on Hillary, and she's sitting there with this nice, big smile on her face. Did you see when they zoomed in on Obama? Not at all. They didn't zoom in on Obama. They zoomed in on Hillary, and actually, I think she was sitting right behind Obama. So, basically, of course, the media, the people who control the media, right now are pushing Hillary Clinton. However, I do think that there is the real candidate is yet to be discussed, and I think that's John Edwards, who's been picked by the establishment to become the next president. So it's going to be very interesting to see, you know, if certainly they're pushing Obama and Hillary now in the early parts of the campaign, and then they're going to bring on the dark horse, who's John Edwards. This is the way it looks to me, but it's early in the campaign, and I could certainly be wrong.
Yeah, I wouldn't hazard much of a chance for anyone except Hillary, but whether or not she'll be asked the kinds of questions, whether or not she'll be followed now intensively enough, and whether she'll be able to control herself, which apparently, at least in private, she does not, we'll get to see. The idea that because we as a culture value equality, that a fair number of people are saying, I would feel so much better if we elected a woman because, well, just because she is a woman. Or think about Nancy Pelosi. I regard it personally as neither pro nor con that she happens to be a woman. She's the Speaker of the House. Fine. But that what's good about the fact that she's a woman, that is the Speaker of the House is a woman, how is that progress? How is that better? I don't see it. And likewise, for a woman to become the president, men and women are different. Even political women are different than political men. I'm not at all sure that the sex differences that exist don't have something to do with the basic nature of what the sexes are like. And personally, I find it rather concernful that so many people in the media think it's a good thing, irrespective of what the country needs, and irrespective of what the person might do, just because she's a woman, she ought to be elected.
Well, I would certainly hope that they would not want to elect Hillary Clinton because, of course, we'll tell you sometime later some of the things I know about Hillary personally that I think we could verify, but they would not be very flattering about her femininity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, our guest is Paul Comeron. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Paul, go ahead, pick the story up there.
Well, if you think about our society over the last 100 years, and you think back to 1905, when Teddy Roosevelt was talking about the state of the nation, you'll recall that in his State of the Nation speech, he mentioned a disturbing fact that was occurring. He said that women were getting into the workplace, and this was disturbing both marriage and the reproductive rate in our society. He was concerned because, as you'll recall, back when the Founding Fathers met, the average woman was turning out about 7 children apiece. When Teddy Roosevelt was registered his concern, we were down to about 4 children per woman. And divorce was slowly but surely becoming more frequent. Women going into the workforce was, on the one hand, making more stuff, making more goods and services, making the country wealthier. But on the other, the price we were paying was fewer children and more domestic disturbance. We're down a piece from that now. We're about 100 years later. And now, in the United States, women are down to just slightly over 2 children per woman. And a society needs 2.1 children per woman to just stay even, just to survive. In Europe right now, Europe is getting about 1.5 children per woman from its population. Women are working there, too. The notion of equality, that men and women ought to be the same, that men have probably historically been rather sexual ne'er-do-wells, or very frequently there, not being very loyal, not being very reserved, not being very faithful. But now women are joining them, and divorce is becoming more and more prevalent. In Europe, you have a situation where Europe is literally dying in before our very eyes, where we have a situation where, by the best demography that we can devise, it appears that Europe will have half the number of people in it in just 65 years. Now, it varies from culture, from country to country, but generally speaking, Europe is sick, literally sick to death. And we're headed in that same direction. And part of this is our demand, our drive, the siren song of equality. Everybody.
Hold that thought, Paul. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest, of course, is Dr. Paul Comeron. We're talking about this, what is happening to the demographics of our country. America has about a little over 2.1 children per family, and that is just about the level that we can reproduce ourselves. And, of course, we're killing our children off by abortion and by sending contraceptives. And we're just not having the number of children we used to, women are not having the number they used to have. In Europe, of course, it's even worse. In some places, it's 1.5 children per family. It's about 1.2 children per family in Italy, or 1.2 children per family in Russia. These areas are simply being destroyed. They're committing suicide. In France today, they're actually paying women to have children. They realize the implications. This is going to destroy the land. And, of course, the Muslims are having 7.6 children per family, and very soon Europe will be a Muslim continent, just exactly as Asia is. You have to understand that the consequences for what's happening, and so many people tragically have believed this lie that women are just like men. They ought to be able to go out and just have a good time, sexual promiscuity, don't bother to get married, don't have children, and of course I think when a society accepts that, we destroy the foundation of the family, and the foundation is the very essence of society. You destroy the family, you destroy society. Would you agree or disagree with that, Paul?
I very much agree. And one has to be concerned that all our theoreticians, most of the economists, for instance, in our society, most of the politicians have said there are really two major factors that we've got to get a hold of and control. One is to make sure that we produce more than enough goods and services to meet everybody's needs and then some. And secondly, to make sure that we have a law-abiding society, that the rules are followed and so forth. Both of those are very important components of a successful society. But we've pretty much neglected children. We've pretty much neglected marriage as being one of the three major legs on which a society rests.
And of course, we're taking away the authority from the father figure. We're telling him, you can't not discipline your children, you can't spank your children. All you can do is let them run wild, and then, of course, maybe hire a lawyer for them when they've gone out and committed crimes. You have to be able to discipline children. When we have the society coming in, as we do here in California, saying, we're going to be $1,000 fine if you're caught spanking your child. It becomes a crime. And then we're telling women, you don't have to get married. Why bother to get married? You were seeing the very foundation of Western civilization being intentionally destroyed, and this isn't happening by accident, it's happening by design. Hey, we've got a couple of people on the line. Right now, let's take Ray, who's been holding on quietly here. Hi, Ray, do you have a question for our guest?
Well, yeah. Sir, don't you think that perhaps the marriage of Bill Clinton and Hillary was just a matter of convenience, and that while he flandered his way through the governorship and the presidency, it was just a front to keep us from really knowing the real facts about Hillary and Bill. And I think Bill is despicable, and I think they're both despicable. And
All right, well, let's get Paul's response. Certainly, Ray certainly thinks that both Bill and Hillary are despicable. What are your thoughts on that, Paul?
I don't know if I'd go that far. I'd give it to Bill and Hillary that they stayed married. I think that's good for Chelsea. I think that's a mark in their favor, to be sure. Part of the reason they're staying together is for politics, I'm sure, more than likely. Bill and Hillary both realize that doing a public divorce now would not serve either of them very well. But I'll grant them that at least they're modeling.
They're posturing, but the real fact remains that Bill Clinton was a whoremonger.
You noticed a couple of weeks ago Associated Press had it that Bill was undergoing therapy for sex addiction.
Oh, jeez, man. Well, he—that's what he is in my mind, and forever we imprinted in my mind that and NAFTA and some of the other garbage that he—I don't know. I feel very strongly about what I'm saying, and I think Hillary. I think she tries to present herself as being. Hello.
Go ahead.
Yeah, she tried to present herself as being our. Messiah, our political Messiah.
Well, hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. And our special guest this evening is Paul Cameron of the Family Research Institute. Well, Dr. Stan, back here. Ray, do you have anything else to say before we let you go?
Well, that's about it. I really didn't want to say too much about Hillary, but, you know, it just, I don't think that she'd be a very good president, and I'm very frightened about this health care thing, because I think perhaps it may be one way of coming toward the national ID card thing, you know, with a chip and all that. What do you think about that?
Well, I think go ahead, Paul.
I'm sure that there are many things that could be accomplished with such a chip. Certainly, you could have much more accurate diagnoses. You'd have much better understanding if you had millions of people and their health histories to see what the effects of taking aspirin, any number of other drugs, how they interact, etc., with such a large number of subjects. On the other hand, we all know that when the government has more information, they use it.
Yeah.
And that, I don't know if the health benefits will outweigh the kinds of control and kinds of influence that the government can have at our expense.
I share your concern, Ray.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Okay, thanks.
Okay,
bye.
Fine. Let's quickly go to Mike here. Mike, did you have a question for our guest?
Well, first comment, I just think Bill and Hillary are two peas in a pod. They're perfect for each other. I think they hate each other equally. And I hope they stay together, because I hate to think of them on the loose to destroy anybody else.
Well, I'll tell you what, I think it's very interesting. We had a Bush for president, then we had a Clinton for president, then we had a Bush for president, and
yeah.
Wouldn't it be interesting, we ended up with another Clinton.
Well, it's all in the family, isn't it?
Right. And, of course, for anybody who doesn't understand, why, George Herbert Walker Bush and Bill Clinton are the best of friends. All this idea about them being political opponents, absolute, well, it just is not true. They create our reality, but the Bush family has been working very closely with Ted Kennedy, passing the legislation Ted Kennedy couldn't get through, the No Child Left Behind program, the Medicare drug program. All of these were Ted Kennedy's programs, which the Bushes got through. There's not a dime's worth of difference between the Republicans and the Democrats, at least at the top level. We've got some congressmen there who really do believe in Republican principles, but they twist their arms and say, you're not going to get reelected unless you do what we tell you to, and the tragedy is most of them compromise their principles because they're not dedicated to the right or the left. They're just dedicated to staying in Washington, D.C. Anything else you want to say, Mike?
Well, yeah, back to Barack Obama.
Hold that thought for just a moment here, and then we'll let you get your thoughts out. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Paul Cameron, Dr. Paul Cameron of the Family Research Institute. And Mike, what did you want to say about Obama?
Well, it's something about his voting record in Illinois. I have to admit, I heard this from another talk show host, who shall go unnamed, but I do know half his brain is tied behind his back. But this is the Induced Birth Infant Liability Act that Obama voted against. In Illinois, where if a child survives an abortion, that he would, under this act, he would be given a health care. In other words, they would keep him alive. And, you know, I could read part of the... Well, I don't need... Anyhow, Barack voted against this.
In other words, he is basically pro-choice. He wants to kill the children.
Even if the kid survives the abortion...
That's right. Well, he's not going to give him a chance to survive. And so he's really not a very nice person. At least he doesn't value human life.
You know, this is a real thing. It's Senate Bill 1661 in Illinois, if anybody wants to go take a look at it.
Okay, fine. Right. Anything else you'd like?
Both he, Barack, and Hillary are loyal Democrats. They are pro-abortion. They are pro... you name the Democratic... rallying group, such as gays, such as the abortion industry, they're right there. And you'll notice from the applauses that were behind the president from Nancy Pelosi, Bush gave her plenty to put her hands together about tonight. As Dan was saying, Dr. Monteith was saying, there is some difference between the parties, but it's not enormous, and you got to wonder. We're fortunate. Our society almost seems to run on autopilot, even though the Congress and the President try maybe their darndest to mess things up. We are blessed indeed to still have a pretty sound economy, still have an awful lot of blessings, even though we have politicians that, well, I don't think a whole lot of. I guess the audience doesn't either.
Are we finding anything else?
Well, this is beyond abortion, though. They're talking about a living child that they will not keep alive simply because it survived an abortion, so it was supposed to be dead.
And they want to kill it. That's just very simple. I mean, these people have no moral compunction about murder. And that is a case of murder. And the fact he would vote in favor of murder would disqualify him, in my estimation, from being the President of the United States.
Well, we may be running on autopilot, but I think we're running out of gas.
All right.
For somebody like this to actually be in the running at all, anywhere on the radar for President, enough said, huh?
All right, I think the thing is, Mike, that there's somebody behind Obama. There's somebody behind Hillary. This whole thing is showbiz. Until you understand that, and I'm sure you do, why you can't understand going on. Why, first, did they keep focusing on Hillary this evening and not Obama? Well, she's going to get the nod from the media, but there's another force behind Obama. And then, of course, there's the sleeping horse, the dark horse, John Edwards. He's the choice of the establishment, the people who really make the decision. Okay, thanks. Anything else, Mike, before I let you go?
Thanks a lot.
Okay. We'll go right ahead, Paul. Before we go on, Paul, why don't we go ahead and get your website out and your telephone number. People would like to get in touch with the Family Research Institute. And I take your publication. Enjoy it every time it comes.
Oh, I appreciate that. Our website is, of course, www.familyresearchinst.org. We're a nonprofit. Scientific and Educational Corporation. That's Family Research Inst, INST.org. Our phone number is 303-681-3113. We'd be delighted to hear from you.
All right. It's always fascinating information that Paul puts out. How often do you put out that?
We have 6 newsletters and 6, I guess you'd say, informative letters per year. So 12 times a year you'll be hearing from
it. All right, fine. It's always got information that's well worthwhile reading. And I think ordinarily people will subscribe or at least it will help. Is there a fixed fee for it? Is it simply a donation?
It's $25 a year.
All right.
So.
And I think it's certainly well worth it. Always got great information in it. Well, is there anything else you'd like to talk about this race as it's shaping up, at least according to the media now, between Obama and Hillary? But I think, of course, this whole thing is being engineered. It's all showbiz. I think that down the line we're going to see a lot of changes in the front runners. So did you want to talk anything about the Republicans, or what would you like to go from here?
Well, the Republicans are an interesting lot, aren't they? Here we have a fairly moderate Republicans running. I would dare say Giuliani is kind of a liberal. Not quite as liberal, perhaps, as Senator Snow, but very pro-abortion, pro-gay rights, has a very... somewhere near between sordid and confused sexual history himself, when you think of he and his wife and so forth. I don't know if he's going to be able to withstand the scrutiny that he will get on the campaign trail, especially if she wants to be vindictive. And that will be interesting. You have... John McCain.
I thought it was so interesting when they zoomed in on John McCain during the speech. It looked like he was sleeping.
It really did, didn't it?
And because they, instead of panning away from McCain, they left the camera on him so that 100 million Americans could see John McCain sleeping during the president's speech. And at least Hillary had her eyes open, she applauded at the right time, and she had that nice fixed little smile. Mm-hmm. But John McCain was sleeping. And of course that was done intentionally by the media to discredit him. Go ahead.
Yes, but McCain should have been smiling. He should have been alert. Any Republican running for president should have been on his toes all the way through that speech. My goodness, we're only looking at an hour and a half max between pre to post. If a fellow can't look charming, if a gal can't look charming for an hour and a half, they almost don't belong in politics, do they?
Well, I thought that even though I don't like Hillary, she did look charming, very, very pretty, got the fixed little smile, and she made some nice little remarks afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, as you look at the group of Republicans, I mean, there's only one who I would even consider for the presidency, and that would be Congressman Ron Paul.
Well, he'd be an interesting fellow. He doesn't have any constituency, unfortunately.
Well, he has, I'd say, millions of Americans across this country who look to him for leadership, and much more so than anybody else that I know. Now, admittedly, they're all conservatives, and whether enough conservatives to get somebody elected, but this could be like 1964 all over again, especially because Ron Paul would get a lot of Democratic votes. Why? Because he wants to get out of Iraq. I mean, he doesn't want to continue the war over there, certainly not expand it into an attack on Iran. So if you read what Ron Paul says, he's one of the few people who makes any sense. And he always votes the right way. He always votes for the Constitution. That's why they call him Dr. No, because very often the vote will be 434-1. And that one vote is always Dr. No. Well, Ron Paul, I think he's a man of integrity. I've known him for over 40 years.
I agree with you. I think he has great integrity. But when it comes to politics in the United States, if you don't have $100 million, I'm afraid in the movies you have a chance, but not in real life.
Well, all we need is a million Americans to each give them $100, and I'd sit there and know many, many people who would be willing to do that. Because we need somebody that we would trust. Certainly, we do not want a Jeb Bush, or we do not want somebody who's going to talk about how we have to continue the war in the Middle East. And George Bush has already said that, you know, he is going to leave this mess for the next president. He's not going to get out of there. And I think that the senator from Virginia said it best this evening. The war in Iraq had nothing to do with terrorism. George Bush can say whatever he wants to. We're fighting terrorism. The Saddam Hussein's regime had nothing to do with the 9/11 attack. There was no al-Qaeda presence in Iraq. This was an entirely different purpose, a different war. We should have finished the war on terrorism. We did not. We let Osama bin Laden escape. We let al-Qaeda escape. We steadfastly refused to go into Pakistan and get them. And we should have finished the war on terrorism and come home instead of getting involved in Iraq. And I'm just afraid that every other Republican is simply going to follow along that same pattern of, well, if you just got to stay there and fight terrorism, better to fight on the streets of Baghdad than fight on the streets of New York. And I believe this is all contrived. If there was really a threat of terrorism, we would have had at least one other attack here in the United States in the last 6 years, and we've not had one other attack.
Well, I take a slightly different view than you do. I do think that while our intelligence services are not perfect, they've done a fairly good job. And given what's happened with the Brits, what's happened with the Spanish, even Jakarta and so forth, you have clear evidence that the radicals in the Islamic religion do, in fact, want to deeply harm the United States and the West in general. I would sort of cede to Bush that it's possible that by fighting in Iraq, we are diverting attention.
Or maybe we're creating a lot more terrorists. In fact, the lead article in the Newsweek this very week shows a little boy. He looks like he's about 6 years old, carrying an AK-47. And the title is, Are We Creating More Terrorists? And the longer we stay over there, why, the more people are going to join the terrorist movement. This was a very, very small movement. You know, before we went over and we let the terrorist attack, we let the terrorist escape, and then we went into Iraq and we've antagonized the entire Islamic world. There were very, very few Islamic terrorists before we went over there, and it's sort of like poking a stake at a stick at a snake, and you and he's going to strike back at you. And we go over there and we kill their women and we kill their children. If you were, you know, as an Islamic fundamentalist, wouldn't you want to strike back at the people who killed your family? You might not have before, but once they'd killed them, wouldn't you strike back?
Well, sure. You've got a point. I don't know. I think we're a little bit too close to the situation to be able to say for sure. However, I've talked to... We're located in Colorado Springs, which is literally a hotbed of military activity in the United States. And I've talked with quite a few chaps who have been in Iraq. And their report is somewhat different. That is, they feel that, with the exception of Baghdad and a few other hot areas, that many, many Iraqis are being won over much more favorably inclined to the United States because of the treatment they've gotten from our soldiers. Now, what the net effect is, I'm not really sure. Clearly, as you were saying, we have done, we've killed a lot of people, we have blood on our hands, but there are a couple of... there was a terrible regime that Saddam ran. The gangs, the Sunni gangs, the Shiite gangs, they definitely are dangerous. They're definitely out to harm us as much as they can. I personally would like to see the United States military being given carte blanche, settle the war, not have rules of engagement that prohibit time after time actually going after people who are shooting at us because they're shooting from mosques, or we have to give them all kinds of alerts and warnings so they get out of our way and they can't be captured.
But we're not going to give them the ability to do what needs to be done militarily. We sent 695,000 American troops to the Gulf area in 1991 to shoo the troops, Saddam's troops, out of Kuwait. Now, we weren't going to try to take Iraq. 695,000 troops to shoo, the troops who were in Kuwait. They sent 160,000 troops to take Iraq, to occupy Iraq, and then to try to overcome the fact that we had dissolved the army, dissolved the police force, dissolved the civil service, closed all of the factories there where people could work, and so there was no work for anybody. And then, of course, we allowed somebody to blow up the mosque, and there's a great deal to suggest that this was an intelligence operation. But now we're in the middle of a civil war. It would take a million troops to actually subdue that. And what are they going to do? They're going to send 21,000 troops. We're not even going to increase it. We're just going to surge the number. If we would let the military do what needed to be done, it would be one thing. We didn't let them win in Vietnam, and we're not going to let them win over there. We're just going to keep fighting
a war. It doesn't look like it,
doesn't it? It sure does.
The first Bush ended the war after 100 hours, and easily, with another 50 hours or whatever it took, Iraq would have been, the government of Iraq would have been decimated. There were revolts occurring all through Iraq, and We let it happen. We encouraged them, much like we did in Eastern Europe.
And then we left them there to die.
Yeah, and then we let them hang in the wind.
And, of course, we control the air, and yet, of course, we allowed Saddam Hussein to take his helicopter gunships down there and mow down between 50 and 100,000 Shia Muslims after having promised them that we would come to their aid if they would simply rise up. Why would we have done anything that's so stupid unintentionally?
I wish I could think of a real plot.
No, well, I'll have to send you my book. Have you read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, Paul?
I have not.
All right, I'll tell you what. I'll give you a call off the air, and I'll get you a copy, and I'd like your opinion of it after reading it, and I'll send you my little pamphlets on foreknowledge 911. Hey, hold on. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Paul Cameron here at Radio Liberty. Well, our guest is Paul Cameron. Paul, let's get your telephone number and your website out just one more time.
Sure. You can call us at 303-681-3113. That's 303-681-3113. And our website, you can just put Paul Cameron, go to Google, Google me, and I'll get you to Family Research Institute and the website, Family Research Institute.
And of course, I can certainly attest to the fact that Paul always has interesting information. I get all sorts of newsletters. Most of them I don't read, but I always read Paul's when it comes, because he always has a very insightful opinion, and of course his material is well documented, well thought out. Well, Paul, I'm going to let you go here. I'm going to ask, though, if you'll hang on the line, I'm going to ask my producer to pick up your address. I'll send you a copy of my book on how we can understand what's going on. You know, when I was in the involved with the AIDS epidemic, none of it made sense. It didn't make any sense that we knew how to stop the epidemic, and we were blocked at every turn from doing it. And I even went down to the CDC and talked to the people there. It was obvious they had no intention of stopping this terrible, terrible epidemic. And you have to ask yourself, why? Well, I'll tell you what. I'll send you my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and my DVD, Planned Population Reduction. I'd like to get your thought on it, because if you look at it, what's going on logically, none of it makes sense any more than makes sense what's going on over in Iraq. If there's an X factor, there's something else. Maybe if we could just understand that, we could understand what's going on. Do you have a parting thought for our listeners tonight?
Yes. As you're pointing out, part of human existence is a mystery. Why are these people running for president? And it looks like, name three from each party, one of them is going to be the next president. Go figure. Why? A guy like Barack Obama, we know almost nothing about him. He has a decent smile where we can track what he's actually voted on. He certainly doesn't seem like a man of the people. Why is he even being considered? Hillary Clinton, what kind of experience does she have in international relations, in economics, in fill in the blank? Or, on the Republican side, Giuliani. Yeah, he was a swell mayor. How does that qualify him to be the President of the United States? The mysteries abound. And yet, we live in the best country on the face of the earth.
Hold that thought. All right, fine. Well, just say Paul was just commenting that there are a lot of strange things, a lot of mysteries out there. Why do these people want to be president? What qualifies them, either on the Republican or the Democratic side? And then Paul was just saying, but with all of the problems we face, we still live in the greatest country in the world. Finish up that thought before we let you go, Paul.
Yeah. That is, we must be grateful. And one of the things we have to do as a people, I think, is realize that children are our future. and we must get back to thinking in terms of our responsibility and our duty to get married, have kids, stay with those kids, and do what's right for ourselves. We'll live longer and happier. Our children will too, and our nation will survive. If we end up being as selfish as we're being encouraged to be, it'll all go.
Amen to that. And of course, the children are the next generation of our nation. God bless, Paul. But hang on, I'm going to have Herman get your address. We'll get that these items right off to you. Good night. God bless. It's so good to talk to you. Okay, fine. We're going to be back here in just a moment here. This is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we really need your help to continue doing what we're doing, trying to get people to ask those hard questions that we've just posed. Why did we attack Iraq? It wasn't because we thought they had weapons of mass destruction. In fact, they did have weapons of mass destruction. Saddam had moved them all over to Syria. They go up on the internet and simply type in WMD, Saddam, and Syria. You'll find out that those weapons were moved over to Syria. Our government knows that. Why aren't they telling the American people that? Why have they set this thing up that we went in for weapons of mass destruction when there weren't any, when there really were? You see, nothing as it appears to be. And that we certainly weren't there for weapons of mass destruction, because we'd given Saddam the money and the wherewithal and the chemicals to build the chemical and biological weapons. Nothing is it appears to be, and I think that this is the question that Paul Cameron is asking, and I think you can understand it only if you read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and understand that there is another X factor there. You need to read certainly Constance Cumby's book, The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow, which introduces you to the other dimension. You need to get the four-tape set, The Supernatural, and of course the interviews I have with Johanna Michelson on the Supernatural, her book entitled The Beautiful Side of Evil, the book written by Father Malachi Martin, Hostage to the Devil. And then, of course, my interviews with Father Malachi as we began exploring the occult influence within the Catholic Church. If you've not yet seen the video, it's actually a DVD. It's called Rape of the Soul. It's put up forward by a conservative Catholic about obscene implants in Catholic art. You really want to see this DVD, and of course it's led to the firing of a cardinal out of a Monsignor and the transfer of a laization of a certain key people in the Catholic Church, and not one word about it in the media, because they cannot allow the American people to know what's really going on. They can't allow the Catholics to know. They certainly can't allow the Protestants to know. So the Rape of the Soul DVD is available from Radio Liberty, as so much other material. Go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, and of course we hope that you'll listen to our programs there regularly on the internet. If you would like to hear more of our programming, they're archived there, certainly on MP3s. Go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. Notice the volume of videos and four tape sets and books that are available there that you're not going to find elsewhere. And then, of course, we want you to understand that we're involved in a spiritual war being played out on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers, but pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until, well, next week, I guess it'll be tomorrow night at the same time. May the Lord be with you.